Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So we're going to be looking at a forgotten key to engaging our pluralist society. Now, in the world today, in Europe, are facing a culture of rampant pluralism. And in this pluralism, things have moved on even in the last 10, 15 years or so. So 15 years ago, it was very common to hear people say that all religions are simply different paths to the top of the same mountain. Different religions are talking about one God and ultimately one salvation. They just dress it up in different cultural clothing. We've moved on from that because that situation was actually a very distinctly short-term post-Christian situation. To imagine that all different religions are speaking of a God and a form of salvation was a stunningly arrogant piece of cultural squashing, where all different religions were squashed to look like Christianity, as if all different religions believe in a God and believe that that God offers some form of salvation. When in reality, many of the world's religions do not believe in the existence of a God. Most do not believe that there is such a thing as salvation offered. And so things have moved on today from that post-Christian form of pluralism, squashing everything into a Christian mold. Things have moved on to a more vague form of pluralism in which any sort of spirituality is a good thing. Doesn't really matter quite what your spirituality is, but to have a spirituality is a good thing. And all spiritualities are the same sort of thing deep down under different cultural clothing. Now, that's where the culture has moved on, even within the last 10, 15 years or so. Evangelicals are not going to buy very easily the idea that all the different world religions are simply different forms of equally valid spirituality in different cultural clothing. It's so easy to see how markedly different the different world religions are. First of all, for instance, it's so easy to see Christianity and atheism are not basically two different culturally presented systems offering two paths to the top of the same mountain. It's very easy to see Christianity and atheism are not that. And equally, you look at, say, Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, and you can see they're not offering different paths to the top of the same mountain. In Confucianism, there is no afterlife. In Buddhism, you're trying to avoid an afterlife. In Hinduism and Buddhism, there is no God. There is no salvation. And it's really being entirely blinkered to try to squash them into some pluralist package where they're about the same basic thing as Christianity. Now, evangelicals can see quite clearly, even if the culture doesn't, that we're talking about really quite different religions. Well, we can be clear on it for now, at least. But there is a way in which there is a pluralism that sunk its teeth into evangelicalism and where we see a vagueness. And I want to suggest it all comes down to the failure to put God at the center of our gospel. And what I want to do now is take Islam as our test case to see the difference of Islam to Christianity. There should be a handout in the app if you want it. There's not an awful lot in there, but as always, there's a handout in the app if you want some of the details here. I want to take Islam as a test case for how who God is drives differences in the system in which you believe. Because the reason I want to take Islam is that Islam is the particular pressure point in the pluralist mentality at the moment, or the pluralist temptation in evangelicalism, that we need to be clear on, sharp on. Because the relationship between Christianity and Islam has become the topic of the day. Pope Francis has been downplaying the idea that there is any theological difference between Christianity and Islam, meeting with great warmth with Muslim leaders and praying together. We've seen the controversy at Wheaton College recently, with a professor there saying that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. And that argument was pulled from an influential book by Miroslav Volf. Miroslav Volf weighed in on the discussion at Wheaton. It was fed by this influential work by Miroslav Volf called Allah, a Christian Response. And in this book, here are the opening words. Volf says, Volf is professor of theology at Yale. Volf says, a deep chasm of misunderstanding, dislike, and even hatred separates many Christians and Muslims today. Christian responses to Allah, understood here as the God of the Quran, will either widen that chasm or help bridge it. If for Christians, Allah is a foreign and false God, all bridge building will suffer. Very much the mentality we've been seeing in Pope Francis as well. And so what Volf sets out to do in Allah, a Christian Response, is set out an eloquent, passionate argument that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. It's the sharp end of the pluralistic problem for evangelicalism, and it's the end at which evangelicals seem ill-equipped to actually engage. And Volf's motivation is clear. It's that wouldn't people fight less, hate less, bomb less? Wouldn't we see less atrocities if we realized that beneath all the cultural differences, we Christians and Muslims actually worship the same God? The problems will go away. I want to suggest that being clear on the identity of God, being God-centered in our theology, gives us a clarity of thinking that enables us to distinguish the God of the Bible from the God of the Quran, enables us to see the differences in the rest of our worldview, and offers the very thing that offers the true hope of peace. The Trinity, the Christian doctrine of God, is what will offer world peace. Now, the Trinity is not something superficial in God, but here is precisely the problem. The triune being of God makes the God of the Bible a radically, incompatibly different sort of being to all other gods. And I'm going to use Allah as my test comparison here. And that is not a problem, as Volf is seeking to foster world peace. No, the nature of God is the source of all hope, peace, love, joy. But Here's why that is not immediately obvious. Christians tend to relegate the Trinity as an irrelevance. And let's just cut to the chase on this one. When Christians share their faith, what is it that you expect to hear them talking about? When they share the gospel. When Christians share the gospel, I expect them to talk about Jesus dying on the cross. I expect to hear them talking about God's free grace, his free offer of salvation, and that's great that they do that. I really don't expect them to be clear on which God they're talking about. I expect Christians to talk about God and assume everyone knows what that word God consists of. And when Trinity is explained so often, it then comes across as bizarre. You know, we talk about the three part leaves and eggs and streaky bacon, three-headed giants, all that kind of stuff. And in our culture today, with having relegated Trinity, then it increasingly makes sense for us to think that the different concepts of God in the different world religions that have a concept of God are really just different cultural presentations. Because we're used to the idea that different words, fromage, cassius, ost, are different words for one thing, cheese. We're used to that, and so we assume Allah, Yahweh, Nisroch, Baal, Dagon are probably just different cultural words for the same subject. Now, while the pluralist might want to say God of the Bible, God of the Quran are the same, Allah is less keen on being blended. So let me read to you a couple of points from the Quran. I'm assuming you know some of the Old Testament material about Yahweh's dislike for being confused with Baal, Dagon, and the others. But let me give you Allah's point of view. First from Surah 4. Say not Trinity. Say not Trinity. Desist, it will be better for you. For God is one God. Glory be to him, far exalted is he above having a son. It would be inglorious for Allah to have a son. Or Surah 112, say, he, Allah, is one. Allah is he on whom all depend. He begets not, nor is he begotten, and none is like him. He begets not, he's not a father, nor is he begotten, he's not a son. Allah could not be clearer, he is not Father, Son, and Spirit. He is a different being. He is one person, not three. And it's not just incompatibly different numbers we're dealing with. That difference means that Allah has a completely different character, motivation, and way of going about things. And it's worth seeing this, how who God is, his identity is going to shape how he acts. This is vital as you think through your Christianity as well. As we do this comparison, Allah is the sort of God you will default to if you are not explicitly and resolutely Trinitarian in your theology and in your evangelism. So let's just think about how Allah is different. Now, imagine Allah truly is God. Step into that world where Allah truly is God. What's he most essentially like? And a good way to think about this is to ask, what has Allah been doing for eternity before he created? What was he up to? What was he like before creation? And you could think, well, I have no idea what he was like before creation. How could I possibly know that? Well, actually, you do know one thing. Anyone know it? What do we know he was like before creation? One thing you can be absolutely sure Allah was like in eternity before he created. Alone. Absolutely. He's not created, so he's absolutely alone. So it's possible he has this book beside him, this eternal word in heaven, but there's no one beside him. And so he's entirely solitary. And therefore, love for others is not his heartbeat. And there's actually a tension here within Islam. There are a number of tensions within Islam as the cleanness of the idea of simply having absolute oneness actually leads to internal inconsistencies, while it seems so clean and neat to start with. There are a number of ways in which Islam is crying out to be Trinitarian so as to be internally coherent. So here's the tension. Allah is said to have 99 names, names that describe who he is in and of himself in eternity. One of those names can be translated, Muslims in the West like to translate it as the loving. It's probably not the best translation, actually. Do you see the problem with that? That's supposed to be a description of how he is in and of himself in eternity, the loving. But how could he be the loving? Or even, particularly, the good, the outgoing, the generous in eternity when he is absolutely by himself? And there are a couple of different answers you can give there. You can say, possibly he's eternally loving towards his Quran. He eternally loves his Quran. But that it's a book, not a person. It's more like a hobby than a relationship. It's not a relationship he has with the Quran. Or the other option is that he's eternally looking forward to his creation and eternally loves his creation in prospect. But the problem with that is that if that's the case, he needs his creation to be who he is. And one of the central tenets of Islam is Allah depends on nothing. To be absolutely consistent, we have to say, no, Allah is eternally supreme, but not eternally loving. And the implications for the character of Allah are concerning, to put it mildly. So Allah is said to be, since he's not eternally loving, is said to be the source of evil just as much and in just the same way as he is the source of all good. So while he has these names like the compassionate, the merciful, he's also called the destroyer, the harmer, the best of deceivers. So in some 20 passages in the Quran, he's said to deceive men, perverting their will, most classically deceiving the followers of Christ into believing that Christ died and rose again by substituting a lookalike on the cross. Allah's deception. Now, faith in Allah therefore looks decidedly different to faith in the triune God. Do you see how the nature of God is starting to work out into the system? Faith in this God therefore looks decidedly different. So, for example, the first caliph of Islam, Abu Bakr, he was personally assured by Muhammad himself of a place in paradise. Which you think, that's kind of the equivalent of Clement in Philippians 4. Have you ever enjoyed that one in Philippians 4? Paul writes of Clement and my fellow workers, and my other fellow workers, whose names are written in the book of life. And you think, well, Clement's never going to have an assurance problem, is he? Yes, it's right there in the Bible. Abu Bakr is asked about Muhammad's assurance that he would have a place in paradise. When asked about it, Abu Bakr said, by Allah, I would not feel safe and rest assured from the deceptions of Allah, even if I had one foot in paradise. Let me be clear, I'm not being rude. I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just telling you what the first caliph of Islam said about his God, because he knew him well. It is not rude to say it. It is that Allah should not be considered trustworthy. He shouldn't be held to such a standard. But that is entirely different to how things are with the triune God. And here, we're just comparing the difference between the triune God of Christianity and the absolutely singular God of the Quran. And if those gods are so radically incompatibly different, it starts becoming increasingly laughable to say the gods of other religions, Vishnu, Thor, Zeus, they might be in any way similar to the God of the Bible. In the triune God, we have a God who is not essentially lonely, a God who is not essentially loveless. What's this God doing for eternity before he creates? This is one of those old theological chestnuts. I don't know if you've heard the pompous theologian's answer to this. What was God doing before he created the world? He was inventing hell for those cheeky enough to ask such questions. But it's actually quite easy to answer the question. What was God doing before he created the world? Loving John 17, 24. Father, you loved me before the creation of the world. That's what this God is like. With the triune God, we see a father who's eternally loving his son before the foundation of the world, pouring out his spirit on him, meaning this God has an entirely different nature and character. He's eternally loving. To say God is eternally a father is to say he's eternally loving, giving life to his eternal son. So many theologians have liked to speak of the father as an eternal fountain, or like the son eternally shining out, ever shining out light. That's his identity, is to shine out. So likewise, a fountain, its identity is to pour out water. The Father's very being is to give out life and love. That's who he is. But you cannot say that of a single person God. Only with the triune God can you say God is love. So this God has an entirely different and unique motivation, love. Characterized by, motivated by love. The contrast to the single person God in Allah couldn't really be starker. The single person God must always be motivated by self-gratification. Usually by need, a desire to get, a desire to receive a satisfaction somehow, not eternally full and overflowing, but lacking and wanting to take in. Now, in the Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis summarized this brilliantly. He talked about the difference between the devil, who's the definitive, needy, solitary God, and the living God of overflowing love. And Screwtape, I assume you've read the Screwtape Letters. You may not have done. If you haven't read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, you should. If you really are not going to read it, listen to John Cleese reading it out for you. And these are the letters from a senior demon, Screwtape, to his nephew. And here's one. Screwtape, the senior demon, writes, "One must face the fact that all gods talk about his love for men, his service being perfect freedom, is not, as we demons would gladly believe, mere propaganda. It is an appalling truth. God really does want to fill the universe with a lot of loathsome little replicas of himself, creatures whose life on its miniature scale will be qualitatively like his own, not because he's absorbed them, but because their wills freely conform to his. We demons want cattle who can finally become food. He wants servants who can finally become sons. We want to suck in. He wants to give out. We are empty and would be filled. He is full and flows over." See the difference? A full God flowing over, not needing but ever giving, and a weak God ever taking, more like a black hole. And that's why the glory of the triune God in the Bible is associated with light shining out. Arise, light, arise, shine, your light has come and the glory of the Lord has shone upon you or risen upon you. That night outside Bethlehem, the shepherds saw the glory of the Lord shone around them. In the new city, in the New Jerusalem, they have no need for the light of lamp or sun or moon, for the glory of God gives it light. The glory of God is like radiant, outshining light, for that's what this God is like. Now, Allah's glory would not be about self-giving. Allah's glory would therefore never be found in the way of the cross. And yet, the cross is just where the Son, who is the glory of the Father, undergoes the hour of his glorification. Two entirely different beings of God, two entirely different understandings of what his glory might be. And that then rolls out into two entirely different systems of thinking. In Islam, because of the nature of God, that affects your understanding of creation, sin, salvation, eschatology. And let's cut to just a couple of those. In Islam, revealingly, there is no such word as salvation. Allah does not offer any salvation. The closest word you could really get to would be success. Allah demands success. In contrast, the triune God, what sort of salvation does this God offer? Well, the Father sends his Son, unites us to him by his Spirit, so that we might be brought before the Father as the children of God. Now, this is absolutely critical to be able to spot, because if God were not a father, he couldn't give us the right to be his children. If God's an absolutely singular being, if God's never had fellowship with another, then he couldn't give us the right to have fellowship with him. He probably wouldn't even know what fellowship is. Only because God is a father, eternally loving his son, can you say that the salvation he's going to offer is one of calling us to himself as children of God in the son. If God was a single person, if God had no son, salvation would look entirely different. He might allow us to live under his rule and protection, but it would be at an infinite distance. Possibly such a God might offer forgiveness. Allah seems to talk about mercy sometimes. But since he's not eternally loving, he doesn't offer that for free. And so, when you don't have a triune God, you never get to hear the Son's golden words in John 17:23, "Father, you loved them even as you loved me." In Islam, it is, you are created to be slaves, and if you do well, you will be a good slave that succeeded. That's entirely different to the gospel of this God, who gives us intimacy, confidence before him. And so you begin to see, just in understanding of salvation, the doctrine of God has produced two different understandings of what each God will offer. And so the Trinity is the most awkward snag in the pluralist's fond idea that the gods of all human religions are basically the same. But in the Trinity, you find something better than you find in other religions. In the Trinity, You see something better than can be offered in pluralism. And this we need to be clear on. All pluralism can offer is some boiled down spirituality stripped of all specific flavor. Whereas in the triune God, you find a God who's love. A God who welcomes in failures, who freely shares with them all he has to offer. He offers his own eternal life, love, joy, comfort. Now, can I press this home a little bit? Because it's easy for us to talk about the pluralist out there, as if out there lies the problem. But in here, amongst evangelicals, there's no enemy within the walls, is there? Among evangelicals, there's not a problem, because we're not overtly pluralistic. But if we evangelicals only ever speak abstractly about God, without being clear and specific which God we're talking about, then our churches are going to be left with the same kind of boiled-down religious mush as if we were pluralists ourselves. So I hope you begin to see some of the difference the Trinity can make to engaging a pluralistic culture. We should be hot on who God is in facing our culture, because who God is in any system is going to drive the nature of that whole system of thought. It's going to drive that worldview. Whatever is most fundamental in a worldview will drive it. And who God is will drive theistic worldviews. And so the Trinity becomes very good for engaging pluralists in that we can show, look what a different sort of God we've got. I'm not, as a Christian, worshipping the same sort of God as those religions that have a God. I worship a God who is a father, who sends his son to die for me, that I might call him Abba. No other God is offering that. No other God but the triune God could offer that, even if they wanted to. The Trinity is good for engaging with Muslims. For you see, in the triune God, I have a loving God. I have a trustworthy God. And only do I have that because he's triune. There's a fundamental radical difference. Similarly, take Jehovah's Witnesses. The Jehovah's Witness, not believing in the triune God, cannot have a gospel of grace. Does not have a gospel of grace. Because single person gods are not inclined to be merciful. Where would that merciful instinct come from? Therefore, within watchtower circles, it is a salvation by works. Because Jehovah is not gracious. And with an increasingly anti-theistic society, the Trinity is critical. Because you see, in a culture that's increasingly hostile to the being of God, the kind of language that's used by the most hostile, for example, take Christopher Hitchens, the most hostile anti-theist, he was saying that if there is a God, it would be a terrible thing because God must be a kind of big brother figure. He said, if it were true that God exists, it would be like living in North Korea. The assumption is that God must be a dictator, and therefore his presence will mean round-the-clock surveillance. Interestingly, Hitchens himself had a very strained relationship with his father. He was longing to be loved by a father. And that's what he didn't see, because he wasn't told clearly enough about the Trinity. The being of God shapes what sort of salvation is offered. The being of God also offers clear understanding of what our final destination is. Let's come back to the Jehovah's Witness. Have you had a Watchtower tract put through your door? And can you picture it in your mind? What's on the front cover of the Watchtower tract? If it's not someone praying or just smiling, there's probably somewhere in there, there's a picture of the new heavens and new earth. There's a family, the kids kicking a ball around with a lion and a lamb there. Yeah, it's this new earth, everything's lovely, lion lies down with the lamb, there's peace everywhere, but Jehovah ain't there. You're not getting a relationship with him. It's just the same in Islam, with a single person God again. In Islam, you'll get your rivers of wine, you'll get your doe-eyed maidens, but you don't get Allah. You don't necessarily want to get Allah. What you want is stuff from him. You don't want to know him. Whereas in Christianity, what is it that Paul says in Philippians 1? For me to live is Christ. And when he has this dilemma as to what he should want, he says, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, not in heaven, but with Christ, which is far better. Because for Paul, heaven would not be heaven without Christ. And so the nature of God, do you have a loving God, a relational God, who seeks to have a relationship with us, or do you have a single person God who would only give us stuff and not never a relationship? The nature of God radically affects what's being offered. And so in our pluralistic culture, we need to be clear about Father, Son, and Spirit as a key for engaging it. As a key for setting our God apart as beautiful in his glory. John Calvin said, without thinking about Father, Son, and Spirit, only the bare and empty name of God flits about in our brains to the exclusion of the true God. And you could say to the exclusion of the true gospel. Our relegating of the Trinity has been catastrophic in engaging with our pluralist society. We need to be coming back to trumpeting who our God is in our engagement with our society to set the glory of the living God apart from the glory of all idols.